From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Yep, the Democrats swept the midterm elections, and as the dust settles, talking points will be refined to suit the new realities in Washington, and political narratives will have to be rewritten. One of those politicians due for a rewrite, House Speaker-elect Nancy Pelosi.
Well, we have the first woman speaker in the history of the United States, Nancy Pelosi. She is now in line, succession of the presidency.
No Congress has had in the 218-year history of the American legislature a female Speaker of the House.
The first woman ever to hold that responsibility.
Ed Epstein has been covering Nancy Pelosi for nearly two decades. He joins us now from the Washington Bureau of the San Francisco Chronicle. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you've covered Pelosi for a long, long time, and you've no doubt gotten past all of the labels by now. But the world is discovering her anew, and I loved this lead from Toronto's Globe and Mail. It went, Nancy Pelosi, a fiery, liberal, mother of five millionaire, is on a mission. Now, that's got to be a record.
It's all true. She is a San Francisco liberal. She's proud of it. But as Speaker of the House, I don't think she'll be so liberal at all.
Is it safe to say that demonizing Nancy Pelosi was part of the Republican campaign strategy?
It was a key part of the strategy, and it became more so as the campaign developed and the Republicans saw they were behind, so they increasingly turned to Pelosi as a foil. Their commercials that you saw on TV and radio in many of the key races talked about San Francisco liberal, San Francisco values, and then there was one commercial run by Congressman John Hostetler in Indiana that talked about the homosexual agenda that San Francisco's Nancy Pelosi was going to advance in the Congress with Congressman Barney Frank.
Bill O'Reilly of Fox News Channel's O'Reilly Factor says he coined the term San Francisco values.
But back to San Francisco values. As listed in my book, Culture Warrior, here they are. Cradle to grave entitlements for the poor with a punishing tax rate to pay for them. Legalized drugs, unfettered abortion rights, no parental notification for minors having abortions, and rehab, not punishment for many dangerous criminals. No restrictions on the southern border. San Francisco welcomes all illegal aliens. An anti-Christian attitude. Remember last March? The supervisors condemned a rally by a conservative Christian youth group, Kids. The supervisors called it anti-gay and anti-choice. But the city apparently is comfortable with militant gays dressing up as nuns in a public parade and mocking said nuns. No proclamation condemning that. These are just a few of the values San Franciscans embrace in their secular progressive paradise.
Well?
Well, at least he spells out what he believes San Francisco values mean. But a lot of those things have nothing to do with Nancy Pelosi. She has little or nothing to do with local politics. She is considered a moderate in San Francisco political terms. But still, he can use that as an attack on her. That is the image San Francisco has to deal with.
Now, how has she tried to counter this image as a way out lefty?
I think her advisors told her to appear warmer, more welcoming. And so she refers to herself now as the mother of five and the grandmother of five, soon to be six. She says, when I want to talk to my caucus and give them an order, I use my mother of five voice.
It was a busy day for Nancy Pelosi, a meeting with Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid, a press conference where a technical glitch didn't slow her down.
I'm not in charge of the technical arrangements, but I could use my mother of five voice.
Later in an interview.
Fox News Channel has spent months being very tough on her, but their panel of pundits on election night became substantially more gracious.
Well, she's in power now. They want the access to power, right? But also, you know, she's new. She's news. She's going to be a celebrity for at least the next few months. It is a historic moment for women, and I think the media will reflect that.
As conservative pundits and politicians soften their attacks on Pelosi, go a little lighter, will they also go lighter on San Francisco?
No. San Francisco is the perfect foil. I asked the San Francisco Convention and Visitors Bureau if all these attacks on San Francisco were in any way harmful, and the director of it said, oh, no. They keep showing images of San Francisco, the cable cars, the hills, the Golden Gate Bridge. We can't buy publicity like this. It's tremendous. We're having a record year for tourism and conventions. Keep it up.
Thanks a lot, Ed.
Thank you for having me.
Ed Epstein writes from the Washington Bureau of the San Francisco Chronicle. Now, as one demonized politician awaits image rehabilitation, another high-voltage character leaves the stage. Quote, regardless of which party wins November 7th, the time has come, Mr. President, to face the hard, bruising truth. Donald Rumsfeld must go. That from an editorial 1 week ago in the Army Times. It was only the latest of many such calls, and finally, on Wednesday, Donald Rumsfeld relinquished the post of Secretary of Defense.
Mr. President, thank you for your kind words and the wholly unexpected opportunity you provided me to serve in the Department of Defense again. These past years, 6 years, it's been quite a time.
For much of those years, Donald Rumsfeld was master of the Pentagon briefing room and a media darling. As he departs, we thought we'd review the reasons why. CNN's senior Pentagon correspondent Jamie McIntyre says that Rumsfeld's style was distinguished by a set of signature rhetorical flourishes that tripped up the press corps.
Reporters learned pretty quickly that they needed to have a certain level of preparation if they're going to go into the briefing and tangle with Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. If you asked a question, he would immediately attack the premise of the question, spending all of his time talking about that, and then never answering your original question.
Just a minute. That is false. Every time a security benchmark has been laid down, the Iraqis have failed to meet it. Wrong. Just isn't true. Now, why do I say it's wrong? Well, first of all, it has the benefit of being true that it's wrong.
Sometimes it's best to either have a rock-solid premise or just have no premise at all. I asked him one time, I just said, what about Saddam? And he said, what about Saddam? And I said, well, you know, anything new? And then he went on and actually gave us an answer. The other thing he would do is he clearly liked asking and answering his own questions more than he did answering our questions. Are things perfect? No, they're not. Could they be better? You bet. Are we going to keep trying? Yes, we are.
Are there setbacks? Yes. Are there things that people can't anticipate? Yes. Does the enemy have a brain and continue to make adjustments on the ground, requiring our forces to continue to make adjustments? You bet.
The other thing, of course, is that he could opine, to use one of his words, at great length upon something. And so if you weren't careful, you would ask a question about a new subject and you would get an old answer that you've heard 100 times before and you wouldn't have the chance to cut him off, and pretty soon your time would be up.
One thing that used to really set him apart from the rest of the gray Washington bureaucracy was his tendency to use these gee whiz kind of expressions, among them gee whiz.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Heavens to Betsy. Penny, penny.
Darn good. You bet. Gee. My goodness.
He almost sounds very folksy. You wouldn't know he's tough as nails. He's also very cautious in what he said. He said a few things that came back to haunt him, but he was pretty careful. People were constantly looking for examples where Rumsfeld made predictions that didn't come true. And one of the frustrating things about it was you couldn't get him to predict anything. He wouldn't predict how long the war would last or how many lives it would take or how much it would cost. His favorite expression there was, it's unknowable.
There are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know.
It was maddening sometimes that you couldn't get him to say anything except, we'll just have to see. Time will tell. We don't know.
So as the conduct of the war looked worse and worse, so did Rumsfeld's image to a certain extent, and his performance at the podium seemed to become a little more personal. The sparring was less good-natured, and he resorted more and more to just blaming the media.
He did blame the media, and I remember having this discussion with members of his staff about why they weren't getting better coverage of the war. And, of course, the real bottom line is if the war is going better, then you get better coverage. It's not really an effective strategy to blame the media too much when things aren't going well.
I picked up a newspaper today, and I couldn't believe it. I read 8 headlines that talked about chaos, violence, unrest, and it just was henny penny. The sky is falling. I've never seen anything like it. And here is a country that's being liberated. Here are people who are going from...
There's an element of theater that goes on in those briefings as well. And one of the things that Rumsfeld changed is he became the chief Pentagon spokesman. He felt, I think, he was his own best PR agent. He felt nobody could articulate things as well as he could. And I think there's a little bit of resentment that he seemed to have total control over the briefings and sometimes made us look like we were reacting to everything that he said.
What do you think the popular image of Rumsfeld is now?
Well, you know, people either really like him or they tend to demonize him, tend to think that he's malevolent or has, nefarious motives and things. And I, you know, from my close-up dealings with him over the last 5 years, I just don't believe that to be the case.
You know, to me anyway, as time went on, he began to increasingly resemble Robert McNamara.
Boy, I think that's exactly right. I was on his plane one time, and we were flying back from a story, and the air crew puts on movies occasionally, and they put the movie on Fog of War, which you may know is a documentary about Robert McNamara.
Right.
And I'm watching it on Rumsfeld's plane, and I'm thinking, wow, the parallels here are uncanny. I mean, he almost even looks like McNamara a little bit.
And, of course, in the Errol Morris film, what you see about McNamara is moving between contrition and yet an ironclad inability to see his own role in what he did.
McNamara, later in his life, obviously had some real doubts. He wrote a book in retrospect in which he talked about the mistakes he made. In making that documentary, he wanted to talk about how even very smart people who are very interested in advancing the best in American values can make the wrong decisions. And the one difference I would have to say is I don't see Rumsfeld, based on my interaction with him, ever writing such a book or coming to such a conclusion. I think Rumsfeld still believes that in the great sweep of history, his decisions will be vindicated.
Jamie, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jamie McIntyre is the senior Pentagon correspondent for CNN. Coming up, the Arabic media react and conservative commentators regroup. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The coverage of Tuesday's election departed from the others of the third millennium in one noteworthy way. The exit poll data were handled carefully and effectively, despite anxious anchors and a few panicky political operatives. Here's MSNBC's Chris Matthews and Keith Olbermann, Fox News Channel's Britt Hume, and Republican National Committee Chairman Ken Melman on CNN. Fretting.
Welcome back to MSNBC's Decision 2006 coverage, Keith. You've got the numbers on the exit poll, why people voted today.
And why we were holding back on it, just because these numbers are in
We wanted to give AP a chance to beat us on
no,
that.
No, because we want to be doubly cautious tonight.
Right. We are restrained, we should say here, by the fact that the exit poll data is suspect. Once again, it may turn out to be okay, but it was looking like it had a very distinct, once again, a distinct bias toward the Democrats.
The exit polls predicted the 00 election wrong, the 02 election wrong, and the 04 election wrong. And after 04, the gentleman who oversaw the effort said that these exit polls are often inherently biased.
One reason the poll numbers were used responsibly is because for most of the day they were locked up in a room with network reporters denied computers, cell phones, Blackberries, or even Windows. When the numbers were finally released at 5 p.m., America was getting restless, especially that part of America filling the hotel halls rented by aspiring lawmakers waiting for the chance to give their victory speeches. Or not. NPR's Mike Pesca was stationed in the ballroom of Virginia Democrat Jim Webb. The whole country was hanging on that race, since it would ultimately decide which party would rule the Senate. Mike told us that Tuesday night, Webb's ballroom looked like any other Democrat's ballroom. All the TVs were tuned to CNN.
Because if it's Fox, a Republican is running, and if it's CNN, a Democrat is running. Now, sometimes the Democrats will monitor. I remember at the Kerry victory rally in 2004, and even if they lose, they call it a victory rally. At the Kerry victory rally up in Boston, they were playing a lot of NBC, as I recall, but almost no Fox. Fox, they know, would just get booed at the Democratic site. And so they were playing CNN, and the crowd, and of course CNN was covering all the races, and whenever it would come around to the local race, Allen versus Webb, the crowd would get either ecstatic or they would be inconsolable. And at one point, I wandered over to, there was a small gathering, and in the middle of this gathering was a guy with a laptop, a guy whose name I found out was Ken Bernstein.
Can you tell me what site you're on?
I'm on the State Board of Elections site to get the latest unofficial information they have. However, all they're giving is totals, so we don't know where the votes are coming from.
But the totals indicate that this is as close as, almost as close as you could be.
Go ahead. And the reason why we say no is we don't think most of Northern Virginia is in there.
So at this point, Ken explains how he was doing a little electronic tea leaf reading, and it was his theory at this point that even though Webb was a little bit behind, he really was ahead because the precincts that hadn't reported, if you look at the referendum vote, seemed to indicate there were Webb voters. I don't know. Didn't matter. Actually, he turned out to be right. What did matter was the fact that there was this one guy on a laptop getting Wi-Fi, and he was scooping CNN.
I'm 40,000 votes on each of them ahead. I'm ahead of them.
You're saying you're beating CNN?
No, the state website's beating CNN.
Don't look at CNN. Listen to Ken.
Don't look at CNN. Listen to Ken. One man news station.
It was weird because during the night, the media numbers and the State Board of Election numbers were often off by a couple thousand.
A certain theme that gets struck on this program frequently is that the new media are gradually overtaking the old, especially when it comes to late breaking information, because the internet makes everybody a news producer and a news consumer immediately. Is that what we saw at the Webb victory party?
Yeah, I think what we saw was the trend of the citizen having access to raw data, the source material, not relying on the media as a middleman. It wasn't so much the fact that Ken was 45 seconds ahead of CNN. It's the fact that Ken was out there double-checking CNN, keeping CNN honest because he had the raw information. And that's also a credit. Not every state board of election does that, so that's a credit to Virginia State Board of Election as well.
And not only did Ken have access to the information, but the rest of the people in the hall had access to Ken's political expertise, which I guess he felt was better than that employed by CNN.
Well, he was spinning. No matter what those results showed, there was no way Ken was going to say, well, right now it looks tied, but it doesn't look good. Hope always springs eternal in the ballrooms of the Sheratons and Marriotts on Election Day.
So where are you going next, Mike?
If there's a ballot measure, I will cover it. If there's an election, I'll be there. I feel like I'm giving the Tom Joad speech.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
You're welcome.
NPR's Mike Pesca. It wasn't just the Democrats who were crowing Tuesday. So were the conservatives on the far right who felt betrayed by the Bush administration. Here's talk show host Rush Limbaugh on Wednesday.
The way I feel is this. I feel liberated. And I'm just going to tell you as plainly as I can why. I no longer am going to have to carry the water for people who I don't think deserve having their water carried. Now, you might say, well, why have you been doing it? Because the stakes are high. Even though the Republican Party let us down, to me, they represent a far better future for my beliefs and therefore the country's than the Democrat Party does and liberalism. And I believe my side is worthy of victory. And I believe it's much easier to reform things that are going wrong on my side from a position of strength. Now, I'm liberated from having to constantly come in here every day and try to buck up a bunch of people who don't deserve it.
Bravo, says Richard Viguerie, who pioneered the use of direct mail campaigns and talk radio to further the conservative movement. His latest book is titled Conservatives Betrayed, How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. And he says Rush is not alone in his disgust or his liberation.
I think Rush felt a quandary that many conservatives felt. We were really angry and disappointed, disillusioned at this Republican Congress, Republican White House, but we realized that as bad as they were, the Democrats were far worse. And we, you know, you can say we cut a deal with the devil.
How was it that the conservative commentators were so much on message with Bush? The Democrats have never had a single message. That's the most powerful criticism often levied against them. You're saying that many of these people were disaffected with Bush from the start and yet managed to walk in lockstep?
Well, it's not that they walked in lockstep. I think that many conservatives decided that there were certain issues that were so important that we needed to keep our silence while they were expanding government and abandoning many conservative principles, such as tax cuts, judicial appointments were so important that many conservatives felt that it was important to, you know, make sure that the president and his party prospered. Going forward in the last 2 years, you'll see a radical change among conservatives. It'll be a rare conservative that will stand up and defend this president if he continues to govern from left of center as a corporate big government Republican.
But speaking as a conservative commentator far to the right of the Bush administration, do you think all of those commentators who failed to criticize the Bush administration have something to answer for now?
Oh, absolutely. This disaster on Tuesday rests with conservatives, journalists, conservative leaders and organizations, etc., who were, quite frankly, too close to this Republican administration.
Have you heard any other commentators like Rush who have now begun to lay their cards on the table?
I've heard a good number of local talk shows hosts who were always solid, principled conservatives who did not drink from the Republican Kool-Aid. They're speaking out, and they have good credentials to do it because they were principled conservatives when it wasn't popular to be opposing a popular Republican president.
Looking at this dispassionately as you can, do you see the media landscape becoming more liberal or more conservative?
I think it's becoming more exciting, interesting. In my opinion, about 50% of the American people today get their news and information primarily from what I refer to as the new and alternative media, in essence, the below-the-radar media. Direct mail, talk radio, cable television, the internet, and that's exceedingly healthy.
Do you have data on that?
In a book I wrote 2 years ago called America's Right Turn, How Conservatives Use New and Alternative Media to Take Power, I go into some detail as to how I arrive at that number. I think that mainstream media is going to have to recognize that they are out of step with the American people, and they're going to have to become more fair and balanced, or else they're going to continue to lose share of market. They're hemorrhaging listeners and readers, and if they don't correct their position on the issue, I think that they're going to see the alternative media clean their clock economically, and I think they're going to be dinosaurs pretty soon if they don't become more mainstream.
And so the results of this election don't suggest to you that the mainstream media may actually be more in step with the American people?
Not at all. This election result was a testimony to conservatives' success. Not one Democrat that I have heard of ran for office this year calling themselves a liberal. Not one. And very few would even use the euphemism for liberal, progressive. They did everything they could to blur their liberal ideology and put forth no liberal program or policies for America. They were very smart. They saw their opponents committing suicide in front of them, so they smartly stepped aside and observed.
With regard to the media, you see this as a great opportunity rather than as a defeat.
Oh, absolutely. And at some period of time, it may be 2 years, it may be 4, 6, 8, 10 years, conservatives will once again become the dominant force in American politics.
Well, Richard Viguerie, thank you very much again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Viguerie is a pioneer in the use of direct mail campaigns and talk radio to further the conservative movement. His latest book is called Conservatives Betrayed: How George W. Bush and Other Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. If the election was, at least in part, a referendum on the war in Iraq, it's hardly surprising that Iraqis themselves and Arabs throughout the Middle East would be paying attention to the outcome. But there's attention, and then there's close attention. For the last few weeks, Middle East media expert Mark Lynch has been monitoring Arab satellite TV and newspapers from his home base at Williams College. And he says the attention being paid to American elections has indeed been close, even by our own standards.
In the run-up to the election, I was watching some of the Al Jazeera coverage, and they were going into such detail about the election that it was to the level of offering profiles of which Democrats would take over which congressional committees.
Wow.
In the event of a Democratic victory. You know, a lot of the Arab media and Arab publics in general, with the United States in Iraq and with all the reform stuff, they see American politics now as part of Arab politics.
So, assuming that most of the commentary and coverage focuses on the implications all this will have for American foreign policy in the Middle East and especially the war, what's their assessment?
Well, I think it's pretty complex. You know, one stream of commentary has been actually pretty much exactly the worst nightmare out of Republican election campaign materials. There's an op-ed in the Arab nationalist newspaper, Al-Quds Al-Arabi, today, and the headline is, Iraqi resistance delivers a fatal blow to Bush.
In other words, the terrorists won.
You know, and if you're looking on some of the jihadi internet forums, you definitely see some strand of celebration. We did it by inflicting so much pain on the Americans, they repudiated Bush. That's one thread which is certainly out there. But the other thread is saying, well, what's really going to change? They're not looking at the Democrats as cut and run. They're looking at it much more questioningly. What do the Democrats really want? You know, what are they going to do? In some ways, the discourse over there is more sophisticated than it is over here. Whatever the impact on the Iraq war, there are some who just want Arabs to focus on the positive lessons of the fact that there was an election and there was accountability. In fact, there was an interesting op-ed by a pretty prominent Saudi writer, Jamal Khashoggi, in Al-Ittihad, which is a UAE daily, where he basically called on Arabs to start paying more attention to American democracy for its own sake. And he was actually suggesting that, you know, Arabs who live in societies that are far from democratic should really be taking careful notes. So this is an example of democracy working.
So they've been focusing attention right down to speculating on who's going to be the heads of committees. I guess it hasn't gone down to the level of actually picking out particular, say, House races.
Well, there's one that's received a lot of attention, and that's Keith Ellison, the first Muslim member of Congress, who won his congressional race in Minnesota and who's going to be sworn in on a Quran instead of a Bible. This has been generating a huge amount of attention and very positive attention. You know, in some ways, as a matter of public diplomacy, this is a great advertisement for America.
I know that in the last few days of the campaign, you wrote that you found it a little surprising that Al-Qaeda hadn't weighed in with at least a tape. So was it more quiet than it usually is around election time?
There were a lot of people on these jihadi forums who were expecting an intervention. In fact, on one of them, I was actually following a betting pool,
wow.
or at least an online pool, letting the participants on this jihadi forum vote on what they thought was going to happen. Was bin Laden going to issue a videotape? Would Zawahiri issue a videotape? Would there be an attack? And the general assumption running through this was that were al-Qaeda to intervene, it would be on behalf of the Republicans.
To keep them in power.
To keep them in power. The idea was that this was serving al-Qaeda's interests to keep the Americans in Iraq as long as possible so that they would be there for al-Qaeda to kill. The fact that there was no al-Qaeda video is also significant. And you're starting to see people mulling that over, trying to figure out why there was no intervention. One possibility, of course, is that they wanted to and just couldn't. Or maybe al-Qaeda simply chose to sit it out because they didn't want to help the Republicans win. One thing which is really interesting in following these forums is that they're confused, too.
There are a couple of other things that happened this week. Obviously, at the beginning, last Sunday, we had Saddam's death sentence. What was the reaction in the Arab world?
It's really quite unfortunate because, on the one hand, there are really very few people who are opposed to the idea of Saddam being brought to justice. So people aren't upset by that for the most part. But what people are really upset by is the timing of the verdict, which has been almost universally seen as tied to the Republican election campaign. I've seen so many commentaries along the lines of, this is the culmination of the farce. You know, how could it be more blatant, the manipulation of the process? And, you know, even Abdurrahman al-Rashid, who's the managing director of Al-Arabiya and one of the most pro-American pundits in the whole Arab media, basically said the other day in his column that it was obvious to him that the timing of the trial had been to help the Republicans and that he was disgusted by it.
Well, what about the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld?
I think that in general, the Arab media is delighted to see Rumsfeld go. He's not popular. Rumsfeld is kind of seen as the public face of the Iraq war, you know, almost even more than Bush in some ways. You know, you're linked to a whole narrative of Abu Ghraib and the collapse into bloodshed and inattention to post-war planning. And he's really been the villain of the piece for so long that seeing him go, I mean, it is, I think, important symbolically. But again, there's just a real questions about the extent to which that's simply a symbolic thing or whether it's actually going to lead to changes in policy. And there, again, there's just no real consensus.
Mark, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Mark Lynch is a political science professor at Williams College and blogger in chief at abuardvark.com. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, featuring a new book by Carl Schramm, The Entrepreneurial Imperative, at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So this weird thing happened to me last Tuesday, and I went on WNYC's morning talk show hosted by Brian Lehrer to talk about it.
Hello, Brooke.
Hello, Brian. I've come in to confess.
That you?
I broke my voting machine.
You didn't.
Well, you know. You see, many New Yorkers vote on these big, heavy, clunking machines that are like 30 years old.
These old clunky lever machines in New York, they're very solid, right? I love when you pull the bar at the end of it.
Exactly. And that's where my problem began. Actually, now, often, major candidates in New York are listed on more than one party line, so you can vote for that person on a minor line if you want. And that's what I tried to do, but the switch stuck. And so, you know, I could vote for Hillary on that line. I guess I'm revealing my vote, but what the hell. And not some others on that line. So I kept switching between the Democrats in that line because there were several of those that were jammed. Then I started to pull the lever back to the right, as I'm supposed to do. It stuck, and I gave it a real yank and moved the entire machine about 5-6 inches. And I heard outside the curtain, whoa, and they came in. Anyway, I broke it. But even worse for me, I revealed my vote. Or is it worse? Is it wrong for journalists to tell? Should they even vote at all? On this program, we often state our convictions regarding the importance of, say, the First Amendment and free access to information, and we've openly criticized the Bush administration's handling of those issues. Would knowing how I cast my vote cause you to distrust me? What about other political activities? In the run-up to the 2004 election, we put together this piece on how far journalists should go in expressing their political beliefs. When we put this question to Michael Scholar, Minnesota Public Radio's managing director for news, here's how he answered it.
We restrict our reporters' political activity.
Scholar says the policy applies to everyone, from political correspondents to arts reporters.
So that means you shouldn't register as a member of a political party, you shouldn't participate in a Minnesota caucus, you shouldn't attend rallies or show any other public support for a party or a political cause.
With the exception of restricting party affiliation, which is unusual, his is the policy that prevails in most newsrooms. But just because you don't trumpet your beliefs doesn't mean you don't have them.
This notion that journalists ought to be sort of political, ideological eunuchs who don't have any political views is just hopeless.
Michael Kinsley is an op-ed columnist for The Washington Post.
The question isn't whether they hold opinions, but whether they suppress those opinions to the extent they can when they do their work.
When Kinsley was the editor of Slate, he disclosed who he was voting for and invited his reporters and editors to do the same. Mostly they did. He admits it was less risky for Slate than for other news outlets because Slate is a journal of commentary and analysis. But
I think newspapers ought to do it precisely because it's a fiction to suppose that reporters don't have political views. And it would be healthier and more honest if they simply said what they were.
Len Downey, the editor of The Washington Post, is the poster child for the opposing view, the one that says reporters should keep mum. But he takes it even further. When executive editor Ben Bradley handed him the reins 20 years ago, he stopped voting.
Unlike the rest of our staff, I had the last word as to whether or not the paper was being fair in its reporting on these issues, and I didn't want to take a position even in my own mind on them. I wanted to maintain a completely open mind.
And so, despite all the information that flows through your desk and all you know about the political environment of Washington, D.C., you were able to not make up your mind?
Yes, actually, it comes fairly easily to me. I guess it's the nature of my personality to see all sides of most issues. In fact, I'm rather surprised at people that are so definite about things.
Did he say he can bend forks with his mind? You know, some people can do remarkable things.
Michael Kinsley.
I mean, Len Downey, I admire. But I'm not sure that I would admire him as much if I thought that he was really able to go blank in his mind as easily as he claims to.
The argument against laying your cards, assuming you have any on the table, is twofold. One says that if reporters state their conflict of interests right and left, editors would have to bar them from covering certain stories because the public wouldn't trust them to be fair, even if they were. It's about appearances. We'll return to that one. But there's a second, more intriguing argument, the one that says that taking a political action makes your views stronger. Minnesota Public Radio's Michael Scholar.
When you kind of put a sign up or put your money where your mouth is, you move from observing to acting. And I think that changes you internally. I mean, you can even see it when people purchase a car. You know, how many friends have you had where they struggle with what car to purchase, and when they finally purchase it, they try to convince all their friends how brilliant their decision was. That, you know, kind of putting a stake in the ground makes you vested.
Ethan Bronner, deputy foreign editor of the New York Times, spent decades on difficult beats and managed not to get vested in his stories, even when reporting from the most polarized place on the planet.
I spent many years in the Middle East, and I have, you know, views on what should happen or what could have happened or what has happened. But I also think that the most important view I have is to keep my mind open to the idea that my own view may be wrong.
He might say bending forks with your mind is part of the job.
I don't think it's a question of being more honest to come forward and say, this is what I think, because I think that once you announce your view, you persuade yourself in addition to others. Whereas if you force yourself not to come to a conclusion about a difficult question and to leave yourself open, you will stay more open.
Michael Kinsley concedes that the best argument for keeping your views to yourself is
that there's a feedback loop. Yes, that's a clever argument, and I wouldn't say it's worthless. The argument that I do think is worthless is the argument that you shouldn't do it because of the appearances. And I feel pretty strongly that the job of journalism is to make appearances accord with reality, not to make reality accord with appearances.
As we've seen recently, hypersensitivity to the appearance of objectivity can lead to some lousy reporting. We saw it in the coverage of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. We saw it in the run-up to war. A reporter should be able to call a lie a lie, but the conventions of American journalism, so attentive to appearance, make it tough to say that. In the news pages, official statements come first. Challenges appear after the jump. News analysis arrives in a box deep inside the paper. Not so in European newspapers, where news analysis and commentary commingle, sometimes in the same story. That's the approach Kinsley prefers.
They're overtly opinionated, and you can call it bias if you want, except that they're totally open about it. And they are judged by their readers with that in mind.
In the British case, there is that tradition of being much more overtly adversarial about things.
Jeremy O'Grady is the editor-in-chief of The Week in London.
There is a very traditional ding-dong between left-leaning and right-leaning papers, which tends to up the ante quite a lot. They do look at each other a lot of the time and take account of their arguments and throw them back.
Ethan Bronner says that we should not seek a cure for what ails the American media in the European press.
I think that would be a big mistake. The editor of Le Monde, for example, will on a given day gather his editors around him and say, okay, let's have a main editorial saying that the Iraq war is wrong. Let's get a feature out of Baghdad showing what's problematic about it. And I want a front page story that does something else similar to that. Whereas it seems to me that we come to work every day saying, what's it going to be like today? What elements, what interstices of truth are we going to discover today? And I don't mean this in a naive fashion. I think that we consciously try to keep our perspective on whether it's a good or a bad thing at bay in order to report it as best we can.
But American reporters are people, too. They tend to be biased in favor of freedom and democracy. They couldn't get a decent job if they took what could be seen in another nation as a balanced position on socialism, say, or Osama bin Laden. And our values change with the times. What might have passed for balanced coverage of slavery 200 years ago would read like lunacy today. The fact that no one has a corner on the truth could be used to back Kinsley's argument.
You start with the situation of reporters trying to do their best to be objective, but having views because they're intelligent human beings. Why don't we just find out what their beliefs are, let the readers know, and let everybody go about their business?
But the slipperiness of truth also makes Len Downey's case.
So many of the most important public issues do not have a clear cut right and wrong. And in fact, the public divides evenly over them. And if one of our journalists covering that issue were to have a strong conviction on one side or the other, it would be impossible for them to cover that story fairly. It is very difficult for non-journalists to understand how so many people who choose this profession, and particularly choose to work with the ethics of the Washington Post, have chosen almost to be monks, if you will, to be observers, not participants, but observers. That's what we do here.
Perhaps the problem isn't with the principle of objectivity, but with the form. If a person is not telling the truth, don't put that in a box labeled analysis. Print the fact that it's a lie immediately after the lie, right there on the front page. Tell us the facts before the jump, and we don't need to know who you're voting for. Last Friday, while doing a radio interview in Colorado, Mike Jones took a polygraph test, asserting that he had had a sexual affair with and provided drugs to Ted Haggard, head of the National Association of Evangelicals.
In an attempt to further prove his credibility, Jones took a polygraph test on a radio show this morning. He failed the test, but stood by his allegations.
The test administrator says he wants to give him the test again because Jones was clearly exhausted when he took it, and it may have affected the results.
We're so grateful that he failed the polygraph test this morning.
That last voice was Haggard's. He may have been grateful that Jones failed the test, but in the end, Haggard did confess to buying drugs and that parts of his life were, quote, repulsive and dark. For as long as human beings have had the power of speech, they've been trying to figure out when other human beings are lying. Modern technology was thrown into the effort in 1913 when a Harvard psychology student named William Moulton Marston used systolic blood pressure as a form of lie detection. Later, the ability to measure respiration and galvanic skin response was added by Dr. John Larson and psychologist Leonard Keeler. But Marston was the polygraph's first and biggest booster, using it to promote everything from Gillette razor blades to marital fidelity. Incidentally, Marston also invented the DC comic character Wonder Woman, whose magic lasso had the power to force anyone encircled by it to tell the truth. Wonder Woman! Wonder Woman! Her lasso probably worked better. A 2003 report by the National Academy of Sciences found that, though polygraph tests work better than random chance, they're not perfect. And it concluded that they should not be relied upon for screening security personnel. The NAS also suggested that it's the mystique surrounding the device, rather than its scientific foundation, that accounts for much of its success. That may be why the polygraph is so often cited in pop culture, and why Seinfeld failed the polygraph test he took to prove to his girlfriend that he'd never watched Melrose Place.
What's your name?
Jerry Seinfeld.
Did Billy sleep with Allison's best friend?
I don't know.
Did Jane's fiancé kidnap Sydney and take her to Las Vegas? And if so, did she enjoy it?
Yes! Yes, stupid idiot! He left her for Kimberly! He slept with her sister!
Jennifer Mnookin is a professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles, who has considered the place of the polygraph in pop culture and real life. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the ultimate test of the polygraph's reliability should be its admissibility in court. So how trustworthy have the courts found it?
The courts have almost uniformly rejected the polygraph. It is generally not admissible in court. Courts' reluctance to admit it isn't, I think, simply about reliability. There's plenty of other kinds of evidence that are less reliable that we regularly use, including kinds of forensic evidence and, of course, including eyewitness testimony, which is regularly wrong, and yet, of course, we allow it. So the reasons why courts have been concerned to reject the polygraph, I think, goes to, on the one hand, we kind of long for the idea of the perfect machine that could tell us once and for all if somebody was telling the truth. Wouldn't that be great? But we also have a good deal of cultural anxiety about usurping the role of the jury as the group who in the end gets to decide whether or not somebody's telling the truth. That's supposed to be a core function of the jury.
But isn't part of the anxiety also that if you can lie really well, you can beat the machine? I mean, the famous spy Aldrich Ames beat the machine again and again and again. And even in pop culture, in the film Basic Instinct, Sharon Stone. She proved to be such a stone-cold liar that the machine was no match for her either.
Beating that machine can't be easy.
If I was guilty and I wanted to beat that machine, it wouldn't be hard. It wouldn't be hard at all.
That's right. There's this idea that certain people, because of their psychological makeup, say perhaps psychopaths, will be precisely the ones who can beat the machine. And certainly in the NAS report about the polygraph, which mostly focused on the employment and security setting, pointed out that if anyone's going to have the incentive to study how to beat the machine, it's going to be people engaged in treason and deceit. But, you know, it's still widely used as an interrogation technique by the FBI, by local police departments. And interestingly, they don't want it to be admitted into evidence, because if it were to be regularly admitted by courts, they'd have to answer to legal standards. Now they can choose how to administer the tests, and in the words of one FBI polygraph expert to me, it's a confession-producing machine.
Well, explain how it's used in that context then.
I think a big part of it is about making the suspect believe in the machine. And once the suspect believes in it, then often, whether or not the machine works, they make the decision to confess, to tell the truth. You know, there's apocryphal stories about sometimes police investigators using other machines, claiming that they're lie detectors and psyching the suspect into believing that the machine will be able to see whether the suspect is telling the truth.
You've written about how 40s crime films began to reinforce this myth of infallibility. And you talk about a movie called Call Northside 777, starring Jimmy Stewart, in which the polygraph decides a case.
Keep away from Keeler and that lie detector.
I'm not afraid of it.
That's what I said. I was a cinch. Then they talked me into going up against that box.
Well, what happened?
What do you mean, what happened? I'm doing life, ain't I?
The polygraph test is set up in the film as a virtually infallible truth-telling device. And interestingly, in the movie, they had Leonard Keeler, who was one of the inventors of the polygraph, play himself to give it a certain kind of verisimilitude. Depictions like that in the film had cultural effects that would lead people to have ever more belief in it.
Would you be willing to take a lie detector test? Mr. McNeil, for 11 years I've been waiting for a chance to get at that box. You know what you're up against? If it turns out bad, you're cooked. I'll take the test.
The media love to report when polygraphs are being used. Scott Peterson took it in connection with his wife's murder. The Ramseys took it in connection with the JonBenet Ramsey case. Do you think that news outlets generally are sufficiently skeptical about the polygraph?
Well, I think you're right that suspects sometimes wield their willingness to take it as itself a mark of innocence. And that itself, regardless of what the machine ends up showing, reveals something about my belief in my own honesty. That's a little bit what happened with Mike Jones, right? I mean, he took the test. It actually indicated some degree of deception. And yet, frankly, I think most of us suspect that he may have largely been telling the truth.
And the intimidation did work with Ted Haggard in that case.
That's exactly right.
Jennifer, thank you very much.
Sure, my pleasure.
Jennifer Mnookin is a professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Wolo, and edited by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.